From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We now have American troops occupying the wealthiest Arab country in the world. And the shockwaves of that are going to continue for decades to come.
Today, an hour with independent journalist Robert Fisk, just out of Iraq, covering the invasion for the past month.
Nobody told these people where to go. They had the maps. They knew the places to go to burn. They knew the American military would not be there, and they went there and they burned.
Robert Fisk on the looting of the museum and on Syria.
Look, Syria will not be invaded by the United States because it doesn't have enough oil.
All that and more.
It will be threatened by the United States.
Coming up.
On Israel's behalf.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Shiite Muslims converged on the holy city of Karbala today. They're participating in a pilgrimage that's been banned for a quarter of a century. The New York Times called the pilgrimage an extraordinary display of the raw power of Iraq's Shiites and reported the pilgrimage is turning political. It appears that most of the Shiites want the U.S. to leave immediately. The AFP reports crowds of thousands gathered in front of the hotel where foreign journalists are staying, shouting, quote, no to colonialism, no to occupation, and if America stays, it will suffer. Many say they want Iraq to be ruled by religious leaders. The BBC reports they're looking to Iran as a model. One pilgrim told the London Guardian, quote, if the United States prevents us having a religious leader as president, we will reject it. If our leader orders us to turn ourselves into bombs, we can make the U.S. leave Iraq. On the outer wall of the Imam Hussein Mosque in Karbala, a poster from the Shia clerics says no one should organize marches or join a political party without their permission. Some are expressing thanks to the U.S. for toppling Saddam Hussein. U.S. troops are staying away from the city during the pilgrimage to avoid inciting even more agitation for an end to foreign occupation. Meanwhile, more than 4,000 Shias staged an anti-American protest in Baghdad yesterday as the new U.S. ruler of Iraq, retired General Jay Garner, spent his first day in Baghdad. Around 1,000 Iraqi Shiites staged a second day of angry demonstrations in Baghdad today. They're protesting the arrest of a prominent mullah, Sheikh Mohammed al-Fartusi, by U.S. forces. The U.S. military will not confirm the arrest. The long-banned Iraq Communist Party has distributed the first newspaper in the Iraqi capital after the fall of Saddam Hussein. The newspaper is called The Way of the People and was a popular daily in the years before Hussein's rule. The top story was about the fall of Saddam and railed against his regime. Other headlines read, thousands dead in bombings and humanitarian groups, oil protected, not Iraqi people. The Communist Party has taken over an abandoned and looted building in a Baghdad suburb formerly used by Saddam's security police. Other parties are also setting up shop. The Liberal Democratic Movement has taken over the building formerly used by the Union of Iraqi Students, and the National Arab Democratic Movement is in a cultural center. U.S.-backed Ahmad Chalabi has established his headquarters for the Iraqi National Congress in one of Baghdad's top country clubs, the Hunting Club. Meanwhile, it has emerged that U.S. Marines shot and killed two members of the Iraqi National Congress and one member of Chalabi's militia, the Free Iraqi Forces, in Baghdad on Friday. A U.S. tank shot the men in their car outside the central bank. Marines were guarding the bank to stop men who'd been using rocket-propelled grenades and welding equipment to blast through the vault. The survivor said they did not realize U.S. troops were telling them to leave the area. Reuters is reporting the U.S. is focusing on former Iraqi weapons scientists after failing to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Some U.S. officials have even begun to suggest that finding scientists who will testify to Saddam's arms ambitions could be enough to fulfill the Bush administration's justification for the invasion, even if actual weapons are never found. One senior administration official speaking on condition of anonymity said the issue is not how many weapons are found, but the fact that Saddam repeatedly refused to prove he had abandoned these weapons programs. The official said that means, quote, it was his intention to have a WMD capability and use it when necessary. In his State of the Union address, President Bush described a vast Iraqi weapons program, including 500 tons of chemical weapons, 25,000 liters of anthrax, and 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin. Meanwhile, the British government yesterday promised that any suspected weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq will be independently verified. Foreign Office Minister Mike O'Brien suggested United Nations inspectors could do the verification. Syria's foreign minister yesterday confirmed that his country's border with Iraq had been sealed. The BBC reports that while most of the fighting is over, civilians are continuing to die. A correspondent visited a hospital in Hilla, where young children are continuing to be killed and severely injured by U.S. cluster bombs. And Nina Simone has died. She passed away at her home in the south of France at the age of 70. Her fusion of blues, soul, folk, jazz, and popular music paved the way for countless singers who followed in her footsteps. She was also a political force. Her uncompromising stance against racism, sexism, and discrimination made her a lightning rod during the civil rights movement. Simone was born Eunice Wayman in Tryon, North Carolina, in 1933, one of eight children.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset.
Nina Simone died yesterday at the age of 70. As we turn now to Robert Fisk, longtime correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent, he's just out of Iraq after a month. We're spending the hour with him. I began by asking him just to describe his thoughts.
My assumption is that, you know, history has a way of repeating itself. I was talking to a very military Shiite Muslim from Najaf, only about, what, 6 days ago now, 5 days ago. And someone, a journalist, was saying to him, do you realize how historic these days are? And I said to him, do you realize how history is repeating itself? And he turned to me and said, yes, history is repeating itself. And I knew what he meant. He was referring to the British invasion of Iraq in 1917 under Lieutenant General Sir Stanley Maud. When we turned up in Baghdad and issued, Sir Stanley Maud issued a document saying, we have come here not as conquerors, but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny. And within 3 years, we were losing hundreds of men every year in a guerrilla war against the Iraqis who wanted real liberation, not by us from the Ottomans, but by them from us. And I think that's what's going to happen with the Americans in Iraq. I think a war of liberation will begin quite soon, which of course will be first referred to as a war by terrorists, by Al-Qaeda, by remnants of Saddam regime. Remnants, remember that word, remnants. But it will be a war waged particularly by Shiite Muslims against the Americans and the British to get us out of Iraq. And that will happen. And our dreams that we can liberate these people will not be fulfilled in this scenario. So what I've been writing about in the last few days has been very simply the following. that we claim we want to preserve the national heritage of the Iraqi people. And yet my own count of government buildings burning in Baghdad before I left was 158, of which the only buildings protected by the United States Army and Marines were the Ministry of Interior, which has the intelligence corps of Iraq, and the Ministry of Oil. And I needn't say anything more about that. Every other ministry was burning. Even the Ministry of Higher Education, Computer Science, was burning. In some cases, American Marines were sitting on the wall next to the ministries, watching them burn. And the Computer Science Ministry actually talked to the Marine, Corporal Ty Norholm. In fact, I actually called his fiance to say he was safe and well. So the Americans have allowed the entire core and infrastructure of the next government of Iraq to be destroyed, keeping only the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of Oil. And that tells, unfortunately, its own story. On top of that, I was one of the first journalists to walk into the National Archaeological Museum and the National Library of Archives, with all the Ottoman and state archives, and the Quranic Library of the Ministry of Religious Endowment, and all were burned in about, petrol was poured on these documents at about 3,000 degrees heat. Ironically, with that awful irony that I'm afraid one finds out here, I managed to rescue 26 pages of the Ottoman documentation, the Ottoman library. Documents of revictualing Ottoman armies, camel thieves, letters from the Sheriff Hussein of Mecca to Ali Pasha, Ottoman ruler of Baghdad. And when I got to the Jordanian border, the Jordanian customs authorities stole these documents from me and refused even to give me a receipt for them. A shattering comment, on, I'm afraid to say, on the Arab world, but particularly on the American occupation of Baghdad. After the Quranic library was set on fire, I raced to the headquarters of Submarine 4th Division headquarters in Baghdad and said, there is this massive Quranic library on fire. What can you do? And under the Geneva Conventions, the U.S. occupation forces, whatever occupation forces they are, and of course they happen to be American, have a moral duty, have a legal duty indeed, to protect the documents and the various embassies. And there was a young officer got on the radio and said there's some kind of biblical library, biblical for goodness sakes, on fire. I gave them the exact map locations, the collaterals on the maps for the Marines, and nobody went there. And all those Qurans were burned. Qurans going back to the 17th, 16th century, burned totally. So somebody has an interest in destroying the center of a new government and the cultural identity of Iraq. Now, the American line on this is, well, these are Saddamite remnants, remnants of the Saddam regime. I don't believe this. If I was a remnant of a Saddam regime and I was given, let us say, $20,000 to go and destroy the library, I'd say thank you very much. And when the regime is gone, I would pocket the money. I wouldn't go and destroy the library. I don't need to. I've got the money. So somebody or some institution or some organization today now is actively setting out to destroy the cultural identity of Iraq and the ministries which will form the core of a new Iraq government. Who could be behind that, and who would permit it to happen, and why is it that the United States military, so famed for its ability to fight its way across the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and come into Baghdad, will not act under the Geneva Conventions to protect these institutions? That is the question, and I do not have an answer to it.
There was a report today that said that the U.S. Army ignored warnings from its own civilian advisors that could have prevented the looting of Baghdad's National Museum. This was in the London Observer. It said that the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, set up to supervise the reconstruction, identified the museum as a prime target for looters in a memo to Army commanders a month ago. The memo said it should be the second priority for the Army after securing the National Bank. General Jay Garner, who's taking over, is said to be livid. One angry reconstruction official told the Observer, quote, "We asked for just a few soldiers at each building, or if they feared snipers, then just one or two tanks. The tanks were doing nothing once they got inside the city, yet the generals refused to deploy them."
Yeah, well, it's good to see the Observer, as always, in London, is a bit late on the story. But, you know, there was a website set up between American archaeologists and the Pentagon many weeks ago, listing those areas of vital national heritage to Iraq, which might be looted, damaged, stormed, burned. The museum was on that list. The museum I have seen physically marked on the satellite pictures, which the American Marines have to move around inside Baghdad. They know it's there. They know what it is. Now, when I got to the museum, which is far more than a week ago, there were gun battles going on between rioters and looters. There were bullets skittering up the walls of apartment blocks outside. But it was quite clear when I walked in that the looting was quite clearly, someone had opened the doors, the huge safe doors of the storeroom of the museum with a key. The looting was on a most detailed, precise, and coordinated scale. The people knew what they wanted to go for. Those Grecian statues they didn't want, they decapitated and threw to the floor. Those earrings and gold ornaments and bullwing gods that they wanted to take, they took. And within a few days, those priceless heritage items of Iraq's history were on sale in Europe and in America. I don't believe that that happened by chance. Two of the interesting things, number one is the looters knew what they wanted and they got it out of the country with a speed that we as journalists cannot get our stories out of the country. Secondly, and much more seriously in the long term, the arsonists, the men who were going around burning, they must have had maps. They knew where to go. They knew what would not be defended by the Americans. In one case, you know, this is a city without electricity, without water. I recognized one of the men who was burning. He had a small beard, a goatee beard, and well, sort of goatee beard, and he had a red T-shirt. And the second time I saw him, I looked at him, and he pointed a Kalashnikov rifle at me. He realized I recognized him. They were coming to the scenes of arsons in blue and white buses. God knows what these buses were from. They weren't city corporation buses, although city corporation buses were being used by looters. But the arsonists were an army. They were calculated. They knew where to go. They had maps. They were told where to go. Who told them where to go? Who told them where the Americans would not shoot at them and would not harm them? This is a very, very important question and still needs to be reconciled and answered. And I do not have an answer. And none of my colleagues, unfortunately, have asked the American military in Qatar, in Doha, what the answer to this question is. Somebody told these people where to go. They had the maps. They knew the places to go to burn. They knew the American military would not be there, and they went there and they burned. Who gave them those instructions? I don't know the answer. I really don't know the answer. But there is an answer, and we should know what it is.
McGuire Gibson, a leading Mesopotamian scholar from the University of Chicago, has said he has good reason to believe that the looting of or the stealing of the artifacts from the museum, with men going in with forklifts and even keys to vaults, he has good reason to believe this was orchestrated from outside the country.
There's certainly reason to believe, Amy, that there were keys involved, because some of the vaults I saw were open with keys, not with hammers or guns or explosives. Forklift trucks, they had the ability to move heavy statues into trucks. When I got there, they'd just done that. But I don't know if they used forklift trucks. I think that might be a little bit too Hollywood. There were men who were guards to the museum in long gray galabeers who had taken weapons, rifles, Kalashnikov AK-47s, to defend what was left. But if you're saying to me, do I have evidence of forklift trucks? No. Do I have evidence that they knew what they were coming for? Yes. Do I have evidence that this was premeditated? Yes. Do I believe that the arsonists were trained and organized from outside and who knew whether or not the Americans would be present or the American military would defend certain buildings? Yes, they undoubtedly did know that the Americans would not confront them. And the Americans did not confront them. I actually got to a point where I was going around Baghdad a few days ago. And every time I saw a tongue of flame and smoke, I'd race off in my car to the area. And the last place I went to, which was burning, was the Department of Higher Education Computer Science. And as I approached it, I saw a Marine sitting on a wall. I bounded out of the car and raced back and thought, I better see this guy. And I took his name down. His name was Ted Nyholm. He was a member of, it's either 3rd Marines, 4th Regiment, or 4th Marines, 3rd Regiment. He gave me the number of his fiancée, Jessica, in the States. I actually rang her up and said, you know, your man loves you dearly. He's a real person. I said, how the hell did this happen next door? He said, well, we're guarding a hospital. I said, but look, there's a fire next door. A whole bloody government ministry is burning. He said, yeah, we can't look everywhere at the same time. I said, Ted, what happened? He said, I don't know. Now, when you've got a situation, I think he was a nice guy. He was a very nice guy. I was very happy to ring his fiancée up and tell her that he was safe. But something happened there. There was a fire. An entire government ministry was being burned down next to him, and he did nothing. It didn't seem strange to him that he wasn't asked to do anything. Now, there's something strange about that. It's not a question of what an American academic said. You know, there's something wrong with the moral probity of an army that doesn't stop looting and arson. There's something terribly wrong there. My country's army in Basra was also remiss in this way. Our Minister of Defense, the so-called Jeffrey Hoon, said, oh, well, you know, they were liberating their own property when people were looting hospitals, for God's sakes. So the British don't get off with this either, but the Americans were most remiss. And in the city of Baghdad, against all the international conventions, particularly the Geneva Conventions, which have a specific reference to pillage. In fact, pillage appears as a crime against humanity in the Hague Conventions of 1907, upon which the Geneva Conventions of 1949 were based. There is a whole reference to pillage, and the Americans did nothing. They did nothing to prevent the pillage of the entire cultural history of Iraq at the museum, or the documentary history of the National Archives, or the Quranic Library of the Ministry of Religious Endowment, or of 155 other government locations around Baghdad. And one has to ask the question, why was this permitted to happen? And I don't know the answer.
Robert Fisk, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon, where he's based, a correspondent for The Independent. He has just come out of Iraq, where he covered the invasion for the last month. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. We'll be back with Robert Fisk in a minute.
Give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash,
the late, great Nina Simone, Backlash Blues, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper of Britain. He's just come out of Iraq covering the invasion for the last month. Let's talk about casualties and what we're not seeing here in the United States. You spent time in hospitals, Robert Fisk. What did you see?
Well, as a matter of fact, this afternoon I took several rolls of film, real film, not digitalized camera film, into my film development shop here, and was looking again at the film of children who had been hit by American cluster bombs in Hilla and Babylon, whom I took photographs of. I'm rather shocked at myself for taking pictures of people in such suffering. I would have to say, and one must be fair as a correspondent, that I think that the Iraqis did position military or tanks, missiles in civilian areas. They did so deliberately. They did so in order to try and preserve their military apparatus in the hope that the Americans would not bomb civilian areas. The Americans did bomb civilian areas. They may or may not have destroyed the military targets. They certainly destroyed human beings and innocent civilians. War is a disgusting, cruel, vicious affair. You know, I say to people over and over again, war is not about primarily victory or defeat. It's about human suffering and death. And if you look through the pictures, which I have beside me now as I speak to you, of little girls with huge wounds in the side of their faces made by the pieces of metal from cluster bombs, American cluster bombs, it's dégoûtant, as the French say, disgusting to even look at. But I have to look at them. I took these pictures. The Iraqi regime, which was brutal and cruel, and is very happy, was very happy, in every sense of the word, to use these pictures as propaganda, must also, of course, have its own responsibility for this. But for me, the most appalling admission came when the so-called coalition, which means the Americans, the British, and a few Australians, decided to bomb an area, a residential area of Mansour, with four 2,000-pound bombs. These are the so-called, I hate to use these childish phrases like bunker busters. These are the bombs they dropped on Tora Bora to try and get the caves where bin Laden was hiding in 2001 in Afghanistan. And these huge bombs destroyed the lives of a minimum of 14 civilians. The central command in Qatar, in Doha, said they believed Saddam was there and they would send forensic experts. But I went there a week after the Americans entered Baghdad, and no forensic experts had been sent there indeed. And the morning I turned up, I'm talking about 4 days ago, the decomposing, horribly smelling body of a little baby was pulled out of the rubble. And I can promise you it wasn't Saddam Hussein, but the Americans went on insisting that their forensic scientists were searching to see if Saddam Hussein had died there. Well, he did not, and nor did their forensic scientists bother. They didn't even care about going there. Outrageous, I'm sorry to say. Outrageous. I have to be a human being as well as a journalist. Again, one needs to also say that Saddam Hussein is, I'm sure he's still alive, a most revolting man. He did use gas against the Iranians and against the Kurds. And I also have to say that when he used it against the Iranians, and I wrote about it in my own newspaper at the time, The Times, the British Foreign Office told my editor the story was not helpful because at that stage, of course, Saddam Hussein was our friend. We were supporting him. The hypocrisy of war stinks almost as much as the civilian casualties. But let's go back to the hospitals. The Americans used cluster bombs in civilian areas where they believed were military targets. Near Hilla, I think the Iraqis probably did put military vehicles. That does not excuse the Americans. There are specific references and paragraphs in the Geneva Conventions to protect what are called protected persons, that is to say, civilians, even if they are in the presence of enemy combatants. But I think the Iraqis did put military positions among civilians. I can go so far as to say that at the museum, which was looted, to the great disgrace of the Americans, prior to the American entry into Baghdad, it was clear when I got to the museum after the American entry that the Iraqi army had placed gun positions and gun pits inside the museum grounds at one point next to a beautiful 2,000-3,000-year-old statue of a winged bull. There were other occasions when I could clearly see SAM-6 mobile tracked missiles parked very close to civilian houses. The Iraqis did use civilians as cover, and the Americans, knowing that they were there, bombed the civilians anyway. So who is the war criminal? I think both of them are. But there you go. That's the story.
Robert Fisk, do you have any idea about casualty numbers right now?
No, it's impossible. Amy, it's impossible. You know, I took my notebook. I can tell you how many people in each ward were wounded in particular wards or particular hospitals. I can tell you which doctors told me how many people died in A, B, and C hospitals on certain dates. But when it comes to the overall figure, the losing side has no statistics because, of course, the statistics die with the regime, and the winning side controls all the figures. Thousands of Iraqis must have died. There was one particularly terrible scene on what was known as Highway 8. It was the main motorway alongside the Tigris River with the Islamic University of Baghdad on the other side of the river, where for 2.5 days, soldiers of the American soldiers of the 3rd Infantry Division were fighting off ambushes. Most of the members of the Republican Guard, they mounted there. And I talked to all sides here. I talked to survivors, I talked to civilians, I talked to the Americans on the tanks. The ambush began at 7:30 on the last Monday of the war in the morning. And the motorway was quite busy with civilian traffic. The American 3rd Infantry Division commander told me that he saw civilian traffic, and he ordered his men to fire warning shots, which they did, he said, 2 or 3 times, after which they fired the cars. And he said, I had a duty to protect my men. I have to be fair and quote what he said. He said, I had a duty to protect my men, to protect my soldiers, and we didn't know if they were carrying RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, or explosives. But cars, which did not stop, were fired at by United States tanks of the 3rd Infantry Division. And I walked down the line of cars, which were torn apart by American tank shells. There was a very young woman burned black in the back of one car, her husband or father or brother beside her dead. There was the leg of a man beside another car, which had been blown clean in half by an American M1A1. Abrams tank. There were a pile of blankets covering families with children who had been blown to pieces by by the Americans. It was a real ambush. They were fired at by RPG-7s, RPGs, rocket-pell grenades. In one case, one tank, I saw the commander, American commander, took me around. He had received five hits, one of them on the engine. And he had opened fire at a motorcycle carrying two members of the Iraqi Republican Guards. One had died instantly. I found his body beside the road with his blood dribbling into the gutter. The other was wounded, and the American brought him back to the tank, gave him first aid, and sent him off to a medical company. And the American commander, the same commander who opened, who told his tank crew to open fire on the civilian cars, told me that he saved the life of the second Republican guard who was on the motorcycle, and the guy survived. I have to assume that's correct. I didn't see him. But 3 days later, the bodies were still, including that of the young woman, were still lying in the cars. And bits of human remains were lying around in blankets. The stench was terrible. There were flies everywhere. The American officer then told me that he had asked the Red Crescent, the Muslim equivalent of the Red Cross, to move the bodies, and the cars were moved. But they were still there, along with the bodies, the next day. That's a fact, I saw.
What about the journalists? It looks like there is the highest percentage of foreign journalists as a percentage of foreign casualties that we have seen in a long time. Looks like the number at this point is 14 journalists killed, as well as the shelling of the Palestine hotel.
Well, I think that the number of journalists covering wars, indeed the number of journalists in general, are increasing all the time. So I suppose it's not a very romantic thing to say, but I suppose that as the number of journalists increase, the number of casualties among journalists will increase as well. There were a number of incidents which we seem to have understood. The ITV reporter who got north of the American lines near Basra was returning, got shot by U.S. Marines along with his crew. Another British reporter who may or who may not have committed suicide, I don't know, which has nothing to do with the Americans or the Iraqis per se, if that's the case. We have the Palestine Hotel, which is one of the more serious cases of all. That particular day began with the killing of the journalist from Al Jazeera, the Qatari Doha television chain, which of course became famous in Afghanistan for producing tapes and airing tapes of Osama bin Laden. I had by chance 4 days before Tariq's death on the roof of that television station been giving a broadcast myself live to Doha. And while I was broadcasting, a cruise missile went streaking by behind the building and literally moved over the bridge on the right and carried on up the river Tigris. And there was an airstrike behind me. And I said to Tariq afterwards, I think this is the most dangerous bloody newspaper office in the history of the world. You know, you're in great danger here. There were gun pits on the right. And he agreed with me. And 4 days later, while he was on the roof preparing to do a broadcast, an American jet came in so low, according to his colleagues downstairs, they thought it would land on the roof, and fired a single missile at the generator beside him and kill him. About 3.25 hours later, an American M1A1 Abrams tank on the Jumhuria River Bridge, about 3/4 of a mile from the Palestine Hotel where the journalist was staying, fired a single round, depleted uranium round, so I understand, at the office of Reuters, where they were filming the same tanks on the bridge. I was actually between the tank and the hotel when the round was fired. I was trying to get back from a story, an assignment I'd been on, well, I'd put myself on. And the shell, story noise, swished over my head and hit the hotel. Bang! Tremendous concussion, white smoke. And when I got there, two of my colleagues, one from Reuters, one Spanish television, both of whom were to die within a few hours, the first one within half an hour, were being brought out in blood-soaked bed sheeting, a Lebanese colleague, a woman, Samia, with a piece of brain, a piece of metal in her brain. She recovered. She had brain surgery. She's married to the London Financial Times correspondent here in Beirut. She survived. The initial reaction was very interesting because the BBC went on air saying it was an Iraqi rocket-propelled grenade. Someone wanted to frighten the press. Then it emerged, thanks be to God for the attempt to get the truth, that TV3, French channel, had recorded the tank's movements. And I actually rushed to their bureau, and they showed me the videotape, and you saw the American tank for 5 minutes beforehand in complete silence. There was nothing happening. Going onto the bridge, moving its turret, and then firing at the hotel. The camera shakes, and pieces of plaster and paint fall in front of the camera. Clearly, it's the same shot. 4 or 5 minutes in which nothing is happening. Now, I was between the tank and the hotel, and there was complete silence. And when initially the Americans said they knew nothing about it, when it became clear the French had a film, but before the Americans realized how long the film was running for prior to the attack, they said that the tank was under persistent sniper and RPG, rocket propelled grenade fire, which is not true. I would have heard it because I was close to the tank than the hotel, and it would have been picked up on the soundtrack, which it wasn't. This statement was made by General Buford Blount, the same 3rd Infantry Division commander who boasted that he'd be using depleted uranium munitions during the war in an interview with Le Monde in March, a month ago. And he then said that there had been sniper fire, and after the round was fired by the American tank, the sniper fire had ceased. In other words, the clear implication was that the gunfire had come from the Reuters office, which was a most mendacious, vicious lie by General Blount. General Blount lied in order to cover up the deaths of journalists. It was interesting that when indeed the Americans actually arrived in central Baghdad within a day, no journalists were raising these issues that the Americans had just arrived. They should have done. I did, actually. And in fact, 2 days later, I was on the Jumhuriya Bridge and climbed onto the second tank and asked the tank commander whether he fired at the journalists. And he said, "I don't know anything about that, sir. I'm new here." Which he may well have been. How do I know if he was there before or not? But that tank round was fired deliberately at the hotel. And General Blount's account of it, the commander of the 3rd Infantry Division, was a lie. A total lie. And it was a grotesque lie against my colleagues. Samia Nahul had a piece of metal in her brain, young woman who's most bravely reported the Lebanese civil war, and against the Ukrainian cameraman for Reuters and against the Spanish cameraman in the room upstairs. It was the most disgusting lie. And as a journalist, I have to say that. And General Blount has not apologized for it. So far, he's got away with his lie. I'm sorry to say.
We're talking to Robert Fisk of the independent newspaper just out of Iraq. We'll be back with him in a minute.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul.
You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go back to Robert Fisk.
New
Nouvelle Observateur, the French newspaper, is reporting that a U.S. Army captain named Captain Wolford said, unlike what the military reported, he did not see sniper fire from the Palestine Hotel, but he did see what he thought was light glinting off of binoculars from one of the hotel's balconies. He said he had never been told the Palestine Hotel was the home base for almost all the international journalists in Baghdad.
I've heard the story. I know this. Yeah, sure. Well, if American commanders in the field are not told the intelligence information about where people are and what hotels, it doesn't say much about the American military. Look, I don't think the American military people are inherently wrong or awful or bad. I met lots of American soldiers. And Marines, of course, the Marines insist on telling me they're not soldiers, which is an odd thing for a Brit to hear, but I have to accept it. They were decent people. One young Marine came up to me. He wanted to use my mobile phone to call his home. And I let him, of course. And he said, "I'm really sorry, sir, about the death of your colleagues." I think he meant it. I don't think these are intrinsically bad people. I think the idea that there's some ghastly, evil moving among the American military is not true. I don't believe that. I think they're decent people, and I think they want to be decent people. When the generals lie, it must be hard, as Buford Blount lied. General Blount lied about the journalists. He lied. He was a dishonest soldier. But the ordinary soldiers I met, I think they were quite sympathetic. I think they understood, and I think that in some cases, they were very upset about what had happened to our colleagues, but they were also upset about the civilian casualties whom they'd caused. When on Highway 8, I was interviewing the American tank commander who had given the order to fire at the civilian cars on the road, I thought he was a decent person. I have to say that when I read my notes afterwards, and I reflected upon the fact that the bodies of the innocents were still lying in the cars 3 days later, I was less inclined to be kind to him. I was less inclined to think he was a nice person. But I don't think that the American soldiers were bad people. I think they believed in what they were doing and up to the point that you can. I think that they believed that their war was an honorable one, even though I don't think it was. But I think that they have been grievously misled, and I think something has gone wrong with the leadership of the American military when you can have a general like Blount lying about the press. If to see a flash of what appears to be a camera or some kind of reflecting reflecting instrument in a window is to be the signal for capital punishment for those who are filming legitimately the war for an international news agency, something has gone terribly wrong. I think the real problem at the end of the day lies in the White House with President Bush. There were a number of American Marines and soldiers I met who were very helpful to me in understanding what was happening. At one point, I was next to an American tank that came under fire, I don't know where from, and I thought the soldiers behaved with great restraint. They could have shot at civilians. In some cases, I know in other places in Baghdad, they did and killed people, and I think it was a war crime to have done so. But in the American tank I was close to, they did not. And those soldiers behaved admirably. I have to say that. I think they were frightened. I think they were tired. They hadn't washed, etc. But I'm sorry I don't get, too romantic about soldiers who invade other people's countries. But I thought that their discipline was probably pretty good, to be frank. In other places, it was not. But again, war is primarily about suffering and death, not about victory and defeat, and not about presidents who, I'm so tired of talking about your president, or indeed the president of Iraq, who's a pretty vicious man, frankly, if he's still alive. Where is he? That should be your last question, Amy. Where is Saddam Hussein?
Well, I'm not there yet, but you mentioned your colleague.
You're going to ask me where he is, aren't you?
Okay, where is he?
I have this absolute fixation. He's in Belarus, the most horrible ex-Soviet state that exists, Minsk. I tell you why I think this is long before the Iran, long before the Iraq war, I had this absolute obsession that Minsk, I've been to Minsk, it's a horrible city. It's full of whiskey, corruption, prostitutes, and damp apartments, very, very favorable to the Ba'ath Party of Iraq. And I noticed in the local newspaper here in Beirut, As-Safir, about 6 or 7 weeks ago, an article that said that the Olympic Committee of Belarus in Minsk had invited Uday Hussein, beloved son of the great ruler of Iraq, to a chess tournament in Minsk. And I thought, my God, this is where they're going to go. And if you think of all the stories, which may be complete, you know, hogwash, of how they got up by train with the Russian ambassador through Syria, where else to go but Minsk? Lukashenko, the mad dictator of Belarus. This is the kind of thing, I actually mentioned it to my foreign desk, and my foreign desk said, off you go to Belarus. And I said, no, please, please, not Belarus. I've been there before. It's awful. But I do have this kind of suspicion. Maybe he's there. But there you go. He may be in Baghdad. He may be captured tonight. I really have not the slightest idea.
Robert Fisk, you mentioned your Lebanese colleague who has shrapnel in her head and said she covered the civil war in Beirut, which brings us to a piece you did about questioning whether what we're going to see in Iraq is the beginning of a civil war between the Sunni and the Shia. What do you think now?
Well, if it's not the beginning of a civil war between the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq, it will be the beginning of a war of liberation by the Sunni and Shia themselves against the Americans. My feeling is that there will be a war, it may already have begun, against the Americans by the Iraqis. The Kurds will play a different role for all kinds of reasons, but the Sunnis and the Shias may well find some unity in trying to get rid of their occupiers. You know, one cannot help in the Middle East but be struck by the ironies of history. Just over a week before, no, 2 weeks before America invaded Iraq, a document went on auction at a public auction in Britain at Swindon in the southwest of England. And I made a bid for it. As a matter of fact, I found out it was going to go on sale. And it was the official British document issued by Lieutenant General Sir Stanley Maude after he invaded Iraq with the British Army in 1917. And it was his proclamation to the people of the Vilaya, that's to say the governorate of Baghdad. And I quote from the first paragraph, "We come here not as conquerors but as liberators to free you from the tyranny of generations." Just like President Bush says he's come now. I actually wrote about this document in the newspaper and said it was going to come up for auction, which was a very bad mistake because the auctioneers rang me up from Swindon in England to Beirut when I was actually interviewing, ironically enough, three Iraqi refugees here in Beirut. And they said, "Do you want to bid for it? The bidding has started." I said, "Yes, I will bid for it." And it was originally going to go for $156. And so many readers of The Independent who had read my article turned up that it actually went for $2,000. And God spare me, I bought it. So now I am the owner of General Stanley Moore's document telling the people of Baghdad that the new occupiers, the British Army of 1917, had come there as liberators, not as conquerors, and to free them from the tyranny of generations of tyrants and dictators. And now, you know, a few weeks later, there I am in Baghdad, listening to the American Marine Corps issuing an identical document telling the people they come not as conquerors but as liberators. And I wonder sometimes whether people ever read history books.
We're talking to Robert Fisk, the correspondent for The Independent. He is tired. He has just come out of Iraq after a month.
He's definitely tired, Amy. He's very definitely tired, yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, you might have heard about Judith Miller's report in the New York Times saying a former Iraqi scientist has told a U.S. military team that Iraq destroyed chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment only days before the war began, and also said Iraq secretly sent unconventional weapons and technology to Syria starting the mid-90s.
How amazing.
More recently,
how very fortunate that such a report should come out now. Listen, Every time I read Judith Mill in the New York Times, I nod sagely and smile. That's all I'm going to say to you, Amy. I'm sorry. Don't ask me to even comment upon it. It's not a serious issue.
Then let me ask you about the targeting of Syria right now.
Look, Syria will not be invaded by the United States because it doesn't have enough oil. It will be threatened by the United States on Israel's behalf, perhaps, but it doesn't have sufficient oil to make it worth invading. So the answer is Syria will not be invaded.
As you leave Iraq and you look back at what you saw, what are key areas that you see as different, for example, than the period, than the Persian Gulf War and what happened afterwards? And what are you going to pursue right now?
The first occupation of an Arab capital by a Western army since General Allenby entered Jerusalem and since General Sir Stanley Maud entered Baghdad. We did have the brief period of French and American armies entering Damascus and indeed Beirut in the Second World War. But that was part of a Vichy French allied war. It wasn't part of a colonial war. We now have American troops occupying the wealthiest Arab country in the world. And the shockwaves of that are going to continue for decades to come, long after you and I are in our graves, if that's where we go. And I don't think we have yet realized, I don't think that the soldiers involved or the presidents involved have yet realized the implications of what has happened. We've entered a new age of imperialism, the like of which we have not attempted to judge or assess or understand. Well, I'm 56 now. Maybe I'll never see the end of it. I probably won't. But my goodness me, I've never seen such historical acts take place in the 27 years I've been in the Middle East. And the results cannot be good. I don't believe we've gone to Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. If we'd done that, we would have invaded North Korea. I don't believe we've gone there because of human rights abuses, because we connived at those abuses for many years when we supported Saddam. I think we've gone there for oil. And though we may get the oil, I think the price will be very high. More than that, I don't know. You know, my crystal ball, as I always say, has broken a long time ago. But I'll keep on watching the story, I guess, because like my father was, who was much older than my mother, was a soldier in the First World War. I want to keep watching history happen. I would, however, yet again, for the umpteenth time on your program, Amy, quote Amira Haas, that wonderful journalist on Haaretz, Israeli journalist, who said the purpose of journalism is to monitor the centers of power, and we still do not do that. And we must monitor the centers of power, and we must try to question why governments do the things they do and why they lie about it. And we don't do that. We don't do that.
Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper, just out of Iraq. He was there covering the invasion for the last month back in Beirut, where he has been based for more than 30 years. Been voted best foreign correspondent by reporters and editors in Britain for many years. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Vilkut Suris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! presidential candidate and progressive congressional caucus chair, Denis Kucinich, will join us in our Firehouse studio to talk about the war in Iraq and his proposal to create a Department of Peace. We'll be joined by Harper's Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur, who will dissect New York Times reporter Judith Miller's front page piece yesterday, headlined "Illicit Arms Kept Till Eve of War, an Iraqi Scientist is Said to Assert." And music historian Dave Marsh will pay tribute to Nina Simone, who died yesterday at the age of 70. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Shiite Muslims converged on the holy city of Karbala today. They're participating in a pilgrimage that's been banned for a quarter of a century. The New York Times called the pilgrimage an extraordinary display of the raw power of Iraq's Shiites and reported that the pilgrimage is turning political. It appears that most of the Shiites want the U.S. to leave immediately. AFP reports a crowd of thousands gathered in front of the hotel where foreign journalists are staying, shouting no to colonialism, no to occupation, and if America stays, it will suffer. Many say they want Iraq to be ruled by religious leaders. The BBC reports they're looking to Iran as a model. One pilgrim told the London Guardian, quote, "If the United States prevents us having a religious leader as president, we will reject it. If our leader orders us to turn ourselves into bombs, we can make the U.S. leave Iraq." On the outer wall of Imam Hussein Mosque in Karbala, a poster from the Shia cleric says no one should organize marches or join a political party without their permission. Some are expressing thanks to the U.S. for toppling Saddam Hussein. U.S. troops are staying away from the city during the pilgrimage to avoid including even more agitation or inciting even more agitation for an end to the foreign occupation. Meanwhile, more than 4,000 Shias staged an anti-American protest in Baghdad yesterday as the new U.S. ruler of Iraq, retired General Jay Garner, spent his first day in the capital. Around 1,000 Iraqi Shiites stage a second day of angry demonstrations in Baghdad today. They're protesting the arrest of a prominent mullah, Sheikh Mohammed al-Fartusi, by U.S. forces. The U.S. military will not confirm the arrest. The long-banned Iraq Communist Party has distributed the first newspaper in the Iraqi capital after the fall of Saddam Hussein. The newspaper is called The Way of the People and was a popular daily in the years before Hussein's rule. The top story is about the fall of Saddam and railed against the regime. Other headlines read thousands dead in bombings and humanitarian groups, oil protected, not Iraqi people. The Communist Party has taken over an abandoned and looted building in a Baghdad suburb formerly used by Saddam's security police. Other parties are also setting up shop. The Liberal Democratic Movement has taken over the building formerly used by the Union of Iraqi Students, and the National Arab Democratic Movement is in a cultural center. U.S.-backed Ahmed Chalabi has established HID headquarters for the Iraqi National Congress in one of Baghdad's top country clubs, the Hunting Club. Meanwhile, it has emerged that U.S. Marines shot and killed two members of the Iraqi National Congress and one member of Chalabi's militia, the Free Iraqi Forces, in Baghdad on Friday. A U.S. tank shot the men in a car outside the central bank. Marines were guarding the bank to stop men who had used rocket-propelled grenades and welding equipment to blast through the vaults. The survivor said they did not realize U.S. troops were telling them to leave the area. Reuters is reporting that the U.S. is focusing on former Iraqi weapons scientists after failing to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Some U.S. officials have even begun to suggest that finding scientists who will testify to Saddam's arms ambitions could be enough to fulfill the Bush administration's justification for the invasion, even if actual weapons are never found. One senior administration official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the issue is not how many weapons are found, but the fact that Saddam repeatedly refused to prove he had abandoned these weapons programs. The official said that means, quote, it was his intention to have a WMD capability and use it when necessary. In a State of the Union address, President Bush described a vast Iraqi weapons program, including 500 tons of chemical weapons, 25,000 liters of anthrax, and 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin. Meanwhile, the British government yesterday promised that any suspected weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq will be independently verified. The BBC reports that while most of the fighting is over, civilians are continuing to die. A correspondent visited a hospital in Hilla, where young children are continuing to be killed and severely injured by U.S. cluster bombs. Four starving lions, which escaped from the Baghdad Zoo, were shot dead by U.S. troops after two of the animals charged at them. The zoo was home to hundreds of animals, nearly all of which were stolen or let loose by looters. Donald Rumsfeld has circulated a classified memo to key members of the Bush administration calling for the U.S. to team up with China to press for the toppling of the North Korean government. This according to yesterday's New York Times. The paper reports Rumsfeld circulated the memo just days before President Bush approved the opening of negotiations with North Korea over its nuclear program. It was drafted by officials who are deeply opposed to opening talks that could eventually end up benefiting North Korea economically. Officials say that with the fall of Saddam Hussein, the internal battles that once surrounded the policy on Iraq are reemerging over North Korea. This comes as U.S. Envoy James Kelly has just arrived in Beijing for talks with North Korea and China on North Korea's nuclear program. Readers of the New York Times may have missed the news of the explosive leak document. It was buried in an article on page A15 and headlined Administration Divided Over North Korea. Meanwhile, United Press International is reporting the Pentagon has produced plans to bomb North Korea's nuclear plant at Yongbyon. This news from Nigeria. President Obasanjo is waiting to be announced as the winner of the country's first civilian-run presidential election in 20 years. Obasanjo has received over 60% of the vote. But election observers say there was widespread fraud, particularly in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. In one town, observers saw election commission officials cart away ballot boxes and voting cards to the home of a local politician, where his henchmen filled out the entire town's ballots. And it's just emerged that Nigerian soldiers shot and killed 8 opposition leaders at an Election Day protest over the weekend. 5 others were killed when a convoy of cars carrying Obasanjo's daughter was attacked. This news from India. 23 people have been killed in Kashmir in an upsurge of violence. 5 civilians were killed in a bomb blast in a village. And Indian security forces gunned down 17 what they called suspected Islamic militants in 2 separate clashes. Federal prosecutors here have indicted an immigration official from the Department of Homeland Security for conspiring to smuggle 130 illegal immigrants from Lebanon and Yemen. Official Janice Halstead is accused of accepting bribes, including cash, jewelry, and other gifts. American Airlines Chair and Chief Executive Officer Don Carty has once again apologized to employees and union leaders for failing to inform them about an executive bonus and pension plan before they approved wage and benefit concessions last week. American Airlines management had told workers they had to accept the pay cut so that the company wouldn't have to file for bankruptcy. Last week, workers agreed on $1.8 billion in pay and benefit cuts and even some layoffs. But then it emerged that at the same time, senior managers were receiving lucrative compensation packages. Workers also learned that the airlines had begun putting money into a trust fund to protect the pension benefits of 45 executives in the event of bankruptcy. All three unions at the airlines have withdrawn their initial offer. American Airlines says it has withdrawn the management bonuses and is asking the unions to reapprove the cuts. Lawyers for Louisiana death row prisoner Ryan Matthews filed DNA evidence with the state Supreme Court yesterday in Louisiana. Ryan Matthews was convicted for killing a store owner in Louisiana in 1997. His lawyers say the new evidence proves that another prisoner at Angola Prison Farm actually committed the crime. Matthews was just 17 years old at the time of the killing and is mentally retarded. And Nina Simone has died. She passed away at her home in the south of France at the age of 70.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say, say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart, remove all the bars that keep us apart. To be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do
Nina Simone. She was called the High Priestess of Soul, one of the most influential American singers of the last century. She was a singer, composer, and a pianist. She fused elements of spiritual, jazz, and protest songs. Nina Simone died yesterday at her home in France. She was 70 years old. She was born Eunice Wayman in Tryon, North Carolina in 1933, one of eight children. She sang in church and began playing the piano at the age of two. She studied piano at the Juilliard Conservatory in New York and planned on a career as a concert pianist, but she began singing in nightclubs to earn a living. A 1959 concert in New York's Town Hall turned her into a star. Simone performed in the 60s and 70s, moving from popular ballads to protest songs as the civil rights movement gathered steam. She left the United States in 1973, sick of the racism here, and lived in the Caribbean and Africa before she settled in Europe. As late as 1998, she said she felt a palpable disgust at the treatment of African Americans in the United States. Artists of all different kinds said Nina Simone influenced their work, including Aretha Franklin, Sade, Indiara Nora Jones, and Peter Gabriel. We're joined right now by Dave Marsh, who has written extensively about Nina Simone. He joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Dave Marsh. Can you just take us through Nina Simone's life. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Dennis Kucinich, who is a Congress member running for president. We're going to be talking about the New York Times coverage of the invasion of Iraq with Harper's publisher Rick MacArthur. But we thought we'd start with an artist who fused politics and art, and that is Nina Simone.
You know, it's funny, in her autobiography, which is one of the great music autobiographies, I think, of our time, she talks about how she really tried to stay out of politics, even as the civil rights movement was building. But she was living in Westchester, New York, and one of her neighbors was Lorraine Hansberry, the author of Raising the Sun, who was a very engaged artist. And really, slowly but surely, under Hansberry's guidance, Simone came to understand that her art could not be separated from her work, and or from the oppression of her people and the oppression of people who around the world. And what she did was she was trained classically, and sort of stumbled into first cabaret performing, and then sort of picked up some pieces of folk music. I mean, it's very hard to think of anybody who had the stylistic range that she did. And then when she found a voice to sing with in terms of the movement, I don't think there was another. I think she's a lost artist, I think, largely because she did feel the need to leave the United States and thus didn't perform before people. But she's a lost artist, and she's a great, great singer, and really, I think, the greatest interpretive singer of the 60s, as well as a really fine songwriter, to be young, gifted, and black, which is, I think, based on something that Hansberry wrote, if I remember it correctly. So she was, you know, she was very engaged, and if you follow her work, songs like her suite about Dr. Martin Luther King, Sunday in Savannah, Mississippi Goddamn, all that stuff, you can follow the movement history in terms of its move from, you know, pretty much a protest thing to becoming more assertive, more about identity, you know, more revolutionary and less inclined to compromise. And to me, that's it in a nutshell. But there was just this core of great musicality that allowed her, you know, I suppose someone could argue that she became a propaganda artist or something, but that's nonsense. It's as much nonsense as it would be to say it about James Baldwin or about Hansberry.
Let's go for a minute, Dave Marsh, editor of the journal Rock and Roll Confidential, to Nina Simone's song, Mississippi Goddamn.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about. All in the air, I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Hound dog on my trail, little school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. 'Cause I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people.
alone. Well, that's just the trouble.
Too slow.
Washing the windows.
Too slow.
Picking the cotton.
Too slow.
Nothing but rotten.
Too slow.
Too damn lazy.
Too slow.
Thinking's crazy.
Too slow.
Try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. 'Cause everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Now you heard him. He's one of you. If you have been moved at all, and you know my songs at all, for God's sakes, join me. Don't sit back there. The time is too late now. Good God. You know, the king is dead. The king of love is dead. I ain't about to be nonviolent, honey. Oh, no. Picket lines. Boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot, but all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. And I loved him because he believed it. He lived by it.
Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn, one of her most famous songs. We're on the line with Dave Marsh, who's editor of the journal Rock and Roll Confidential, author of many books on music, currently working on a book about freedom songs and the civil rights movement. Nina Simone died at her home yesterday in the south of France. You mentioned Lorraine Hansberry and James Baldwin. James Baldwin, Nina Simone, did they spend time together in France? And Nina Simone lived in the Caribbean, lived in Africa and Liberia, and then moved to France.
You know, I don't know if they didn't spend time together in France. I do know that they spent plenty of time together in New York and within the, you know, various things that the people did in the civil rights movement. But where she lived in France was a big secret and remains one. Her manager, who was with her when she died and issued the press release, said that he wouldn't tell anybody what town she died in. So whether she was, you know, in the south of France, which is where Baldwin was, I just don't know.
Can you talk about why Nina Simone never achieved the commercial success of some of the people that she inspired, like Aretha Franklin?
Well, part of it was that she came along, you know, sort of beginning in the late 50s and early 60s, before there was quite the completely open access that there was to black performers that there was by the time Aretha came along in 65. I mean, Aretha herself in the early 60s was not receiving much radio airplay and therefore small sales. I think the other thing about it, though, is that her very eclecticism kept her from fitting into most radio formats, and that is how most Americans, for better or worse, at least at that time, found out about music and bought it in large numbers. But it's wrong to see her as you know, sort of a cult artist. In her day, she's a very important artist, even commercially, you know. And really, in that sort of folk jazz world, you know, she worked steadily. She, you know, and she might have sold as many records, you know, in that period as, say, Miles Davis was saying. Selling. So, and I wouldn't think of Miles as someone without an audience.
We're going to go to our break with Ain't Got No I Got Life. Can you talk a little about that song?
It's been a while since I heard that one, to tell you the truth.
So, well, why don't we just go directly to it? Yeah, and Dave Marshall, I want to say thanks so much for being with us, editor of the journal Rock and Roll Confidential, writing a book on the freedom songs and the civil rights movement. Nina Simone died yesterday at the age of 70 in France. Ain't got no, I got life. Got no, I got life. Nina Simone, age 70, died in France. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by a presidential candidate in the Democratic Party, Denis Kucinich. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, it looks like you are making waves. The Washington Post, a column by Richard Cohen, basically endorsing what Richard Pearl said about you in Meet the Press, calling you a liar. After you laid out your arguments against war, and Richard Cohen quotes Pearl saying it's an out-and-out lie when you talk about oil, and quotes Pearl saying, I'm sorry to see you give credence to it. Then Cohen says, but Kucinich, who must have studied logic in France, came roaring back, well, if America is not a threat, then what is this about? And many people are wondering, how did our oil get under their sand? Cohen says, a better question is, how did this fool get on Meet the Press? Liar, fool, anti-war, illogical. You must be making the Democrats nervous.
Well, I want to accept the compliments that have been paid to me by Mr. Pearl and Mr. Cohen. Certainly, the U.S. foreign policy needs to be debated, and I brought that debate inside the Democratic Party and have done it in a way that's resulted in organizing 126 Democrats to vote against the Iraq resolution. I've helped to organize the Democratic Party to have a debate inside the Congress over our policies. And with the sorry episode of the Iraq invasion coming to a conclusion, the question still remains about the resources of Iraq. What's going to happen to the oil? What's going to happen to the other resources inside the country? Will they be privatized? Will the benefits go to the Iraqi people? These are all subjects that are still very much open.
We don't hear the Democratic leadership raising these issues. You've come here to New York. The senators Schumer and Clinton could not be more for the war than the Republicans.
Well, I think the failure of the Democratic Party to provide an alternative foreign policy has been a catastrophe in the 2002 elections, and it will prove to be a catastrophe in the 2004 elections unless the Democrats offer a nominee who's prepared to establish clear differences in foreign policy. For example, my candidacy presents an alternative worldview, which views the world as interconnected, as interdependent, which sees war as being archaic, which sees war as being something that must be avoided. The only way that the United States should ever be using armed force is to defend this country or in concert with the international community in a cause that's sanctioned by the Security Council, that in a cause that we don't drag the Security Council into. Let's look at our national security strategy, which calls for preemptive war. Such a strategy needs to be set aside. It's inconsistent in a community, in a world community where you need international cooperation, and it's inconsistent in a world where there are so many nations with nuclear, biological, chemical, and missile weapons technology to talk about preemptive war. So I'm advancing a candidacy that seeks international cooperation instead of domination, that seeks a beneficent role for America in the world, that seeks an America which can eschew its role as an aggressor and as imposed for war and spending the resources of this country on war and tax cuts, and instead focuses on a domestic agenda, which can only happen if we achieve international cooperation, interestingly enough.
Donald Rumsfeld has circulated a classified memo to key members of the Bush administration calling for the U.S. to team up with China to press for the toppling of the North Korean government. This was buried in a New York Times piece yesterday. The paper reports Rumsfeld circulated the memo just days before Bush approved the opening of negotiations with North Korea over its nuclear program, and is talking about the divisions now within the Bush administration. The internal battles that once surrounded the policy on Iraq now emerging around North Korea.
Well, we know who won the battle of policy over Iraq. This Defense Department did. And it is inconsistent to have the State Department negotiating difficulties over nuclear issues with North Korea, and at the same time to have the Defense Department speaking about an aggressive intervention. It actually is self-defeating to take the position which the Secretary of Defense has taken. It's against the United States' interest. It's against the interests of people in the Korean Peninsula. You know, here we are on the 50th anniversary of the armistice. We should be seizing the moment to actually conclude the peace, which has not officially been concluded in the Korean Peninsula, and to deal with all the economic issues which give rise to the uncertainty in North Korea. But we're not doing that. Instead, we're rattling the nuclear saber once again. And I think that in and of itself, our nuclear posture review represents a challenge to the United Nations Charter. In and of itself, our national security strategy represents a threat to global peace. And this administration is going in a direction that will cost the people of this country dearly. It will cost the people of this country their health care, their retirement security, jobs and education. Our entire domestic agenda is at risk if we continue to have an administration which is preaching war and tax cuts and, in a sense, using the resources of this country for matters that are destructive.
You've got all the other congressional candidates, Democratic candidates for president, who are for war. Gephardt, Edwards, Kerry, Gephardt, Edward, I know I can't make you say the name of one of your opponents, but Gephardt, Kerry, Edwards,
Mr. Lieberman.
Lieberman, who is also the sponsor of the Homeland Security Act. You alone are opposing war within Congress as a candidate. But then there's Reverend Al Sharpton, and there's the former governor of Vermont, Howard Dean. How do you differ from Sharpton and Dean?
Well, first of all, I organized the effort inside the Congress. I didn't come to this simply as a candidate. I've come to this debate as a member of Congress who's been an activist in going around the country in demonstrating that the administration's foreign policies are not consistent with a beneficent role for America in the world, are not consistent with world cooperation, are not consistent with the domestic needs of people in our country. And so I've been a leader on this. I haven't come to it as a result of a campaign. In addition to that, when the United States went to war in Iraq, I continued to raise the challenge, and only candidate the only candidate who was willing to continue to challenge this war and who challenges the foreign policy of the administration. War should not become inevitable. This administration has an international view of domination, And with that kind of a view, it puts this country at risk. It increases the risk for terrorist attacks in this country when we have an administration that feels free to launch an attack anywhere it well pleases. And so what I'm saying is that in order to secure America, we need to have international cooperation. We need all the nations of the world working together in order to make this country more safe. But that's not the direction this country's going.
You said you've been a leader on this issue. You haven't come to this as a result of a campaign, which takes us to another issue, and that issue is abortion. Can you talk about where you stand? Many identify you as anti-abortion in your positions. Where do you stand now?
I oppose any effort to overturn Roe v. Wade. I'm opposed to criminalization of abortion. Now, I haven't always been on the side of choice. My record in Congress has shown that I have rather consistently, through a period of 5 years, voted against legislation that would have been affirmative of women's rights to choose. However, as I've seen the Congress go in the direction of trying to overturn Roe v. Wade, in the last Congress, before I became a presidential candidate, I began to express my concern about the direction this debate was going. And I'm saying very clearly that I oppose any effort to overturn Roe v. Wade, to criminalize abortion. I think a woman's right to choose must be upheld, that it's central to a woman's freedom in society, and that, and not just the right to privacy. And as president, I would make a litmus test of any candidate for the Supreme Court. Upholding Roe v. Wade is essential. I want to do everything I can to make abortions less necessary through birth control and sex education. And I think because of my understanding of this issue and because of my understanding of the scope of this issue, I can be a person who can help heal this nation on this very divisive issue and try to bring America back to making abortions less necessary, but within the constitutional context of confirming a woman's right to choose.
Why have you changed?
Well, it's not so much a change as it is an evolution. You know, this has been a question that I've been thinking about and talking with women about for years. And over the last few years, the women in my life and women who I've come into contact with and having this discussion have shown me in many discussions the importance of taking a close look at the issue of choice as it relates to a woman's freedom and her equality in society. And when I saw in the last Congress this effort made to criminalize abortion and the late-term abortion issue, despite the fact that the Supreme Court had made some decisions that said that there should be a health exception and that the procedure had to be defined, the Congress just swept that aside, I saw that this was just a rank politicization of a very serious issue, and I began to take a series of steps to separate myself from the position that I have that I'd held in the previous 5 years.
So you would support late-term abortion?
I think a woman has a right to make a choice in consultation with her doctor, and I don't think the Congress has a right to intervene on that.
What about federal funding for abortion for poor women?
I think that at this point it's important that a woman's right to choose be affirmed, and that is also within the context of federal funding as well.
Where did your anti-choice views come from?
Well, it's not so much anti-choice as it is a desire to try to affirm an holistic view of life. I mean, I see life as being interconnected and interdependent. And so I've always had a view of trying to do whatever I could to protect life. But then as I saw this increasing effort to criminalize abortion, I realized that we must do everything we can to minimize the possibilities of abortion through sex education and birth control on one hand. But on the other hand, we have to protect a woman's status and role in society. So I've been open to the debate and to the concerns that people have expressed to me about the direction this has been going. And, you know, I still want to do everything I can to make abortions less necessary. And I continue to work with groups to do that. But that can only be done within the context of the constitutional rights of women. And I think that we can achieve that kind of a balance in society.
We're talking to Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. He is running for president, and he's here in New York. I want to talk for a minute about how you became a congressmember and what happened to you in Cleveland at the time. You took on the major power structure of Cleveland, and then they vowed to take you down. And you can you talk about what happened with the utilities?
In 1976... the city of Cleveland, the mayor and the council, sold Cleveland's municipal electric system. The city had had an electric system for almost 70 years. It's a publicly owned system that provided electricity to about 46,000 customers in Cleveland, about a third of the city, at a saving of about 25%. And the maintenance of public power provided cheaper electricity for the city itself, street lighting, public service facilities. And there was an effort by the privately owned utility in the city of Cleveland, then known as the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, to take over the public utility, to have a monopoly. And so when it was sold, I started a campaign to block the sale. And it resulted in a lawsuit being filed that we tied the sale up in court. I ran for mayor on a promise to repeal the sale and to cancel it if elected. Well, I was elected. First act in office, I canceled the sale. On December 15, 1978, the largest bank in Ohio and their second largest bank partner came to me and told me that unless I agreed to sell Cleveland's municipal electric system to this private utility, in which that the banks would not renew the city's credit. Now, keep in mind, the bank, the major bank, had four interlocking directorates with the private utility. And I was basically being given a choice to get rid of a city utility or sacrifice my own career. And I chose to save the municipal electric system. The city of Cleveland was put into a fiscal default. Nothing like this has ever happened in the United States history. I lost the next election. It took me 15 years to make a political comeback for taking that position. And the reason I was able to make the comeback is in 1993, Cleveland had the largest expansion of any municipal electric system in the country. And at that point, people were saying, well, that wouldn't have happened if Dennis Kucinich hadn't gone ahead and refused to sell the system. But I was really offered a corrupt deal by corporate Cleveland. I turned it down, and they used it to defeat me in the next election. I made a political comeback, elected to the Ohio Senate in 1994 on a slogan that said, because he was right, with a light bulb behind my name. And 2 years later, on a slogan, light up Congress, I was elected to the United States House because people realized that I'm willing to challenge entrenched power and do the right thing for the public, notwithstanding the pressures.
What people look for in a president is not only standing up for the issues that they believe in, but also effectively being able to accomplish those. Right now, you're in an extremely pro-war Congress, not only the Republicans, but the Democrats as well. So what can you accomplish now? It's not a moot point. You know, the invasion of Iraq has taken place. We still see have to deal with the occupation. And then you have Bush taking on North Korea, taking on Syria. What can you accomplish now?
Well, as a presidential candidate, I think that I'm soon to be in a singular position on a whole range of issues, including issues of war and peace. It's important now to insist that the United States not proceed unilaterally against any nation. It's important to insist that this policy that they're dealing with in Korea, that the policy that might come up in Syria be set aside. Stop the saber rattling. It's important for an American president and for a candidate for president to show the American people the connection, where if we continue to pursue this militarization in this society, if we continue to pursue spending for war, if we continue to have tax cuts for the wealthy, we're not going to be able to meet the needs for health care, education, retirement security, and jobs in this society. And so what I'm saying, I'm the only candidate who's saying that we have to have fully paid universal health care for all Americans, take the private sector out. I'm the only candidate who's saying that we need to secure Social Security without privatization and take the retirement age back to 65. The only candidate who's calling for a full employment economy apropos of the old Humphrey Hawkins. The only candidate calling for universal education, pre-K all the way through to including college. And so there are many ways in which my candidacy distinguishes itself, focuses on a domestic agenda, and says it's time to stop rattling the sabers and preparing for war.
Universal health care, stopping the privatization of Social Security. This is not going to gain you large campaign contributions from the corporations that really fund, especially those that run for president. According to the recently released campaign finance reports, you rank near the bottom of Democratic candidates in terms of fundraising. Carey and Edwards raised something like $7 million. Gephardt Lieberman, Howard Dean raised all between $2 and $4 million. You've raised less than $200,000 in the last 3 months. For some, that might be a badge of honor. But where do you plan to get the money you need to run, or do you think you need any?
Well, first of all, that report reflected not 90 days, but 42 days of campaigning, because that, you know, I just got into the race a few months ago. Secondly, we have to this date, through about five or six weeks on the web, raised about $175,000 on the web alone at our website, Kucinich.us, and that's been one way in which we're enabling Americans to make their own statement about public financing. You know, I believe in public financing. Well, one way we can accomplish it is to have millions of small contributors making possible a candidacy which seeks to challenge corporate power, which seeks to challenge the globalization ethic which has undermined human rights and workers' rights and the environment, here we are on Earth Day, around the world, which seeks to take away some of the power of this military-industrial complex and media, frankly, which have undermined the rights of America to a peaceful world. So, you know, my candidacy represents a departure from business as usual. My candidacy presents the American people with an opportunity to reclaim their government. And if we really believe in government of the people, then that web is going to be a basis for raising the millions of dollars I need to run a competitive campaign.
Would you support a bill, a movement to impeach George Bush?
I don't believe in impeachment. I think that the American people have to make a choice every 4 years, and we have to live with those choices that we make. You know, I'm not satisfied with this administration, but in the current climate, first of all, let's talk practical politics. You're not going to get a resolution of impeachment out of the House. The Senate wouldn't vote for impeachment. It's not going to happen. I don't believe in wasting energy. I think that it's important for us to focus on creating the climate in this country that brings about progressive political change. And that's what my candidacy is about. And it's not just about me. It's about creating a movement that'll be in place for years to come that'll enable candidates to be able to look at a set of principles which they can run for, which will then reflect the economic needs and the practical aspirations of their constituents for better housing, for health care, for jobs, for decent schools for their children, for retirement security, for a cleaner environment. These are all things Americans aspire to, and so my candidacy represents the opportunity for a departure from business as usual, and that's one of the reasons why, frankly, in a field of 9 or 10 candidates, I expect to be in a competitive position for the nomination in all the major states.
Has the congressional Democratic leadership asked you to withdraw?
No more than I would ask Dick Gephardt to withdraw. I mean, I think that we are in a position where it's important to have this debate. And I'm part of the leadership. I'm co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. So I'm the co-chair of the largest caucus inside the Democratic Party. And so as being one of the Democratic leaders, I represent, I believe, a distinct point of view in this country. I think there are many Democrats across this country who want to see this party go in a direction that's more progressive, that really offers the people real choices, that would cause people to want to vote.
You're introducing a bill for a Department of Peace. Can you explain what that is?
Well, the idea of a Department of Peace is to make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society. When you look at violence in America, it's very easy to identify it in a number of categories: domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, violence in our schools, violence in our communities, gangs, police community relations challenges, violence against racial and against sexual minorities. All of these things reflect pathologies in our society which the government has an opportunity to address, and the Department of Peace would do that in addressing it and creating programs for education and supporting community groups that are working towards creating more peaceful communities. On an international level, the Department of Peace would look at areas of human scarcity, of poverty, of famine, of drought, and find those areas which create challenges to peace and create...
Is it getting any support?
Oh, yes. We had 47 Democrats co-sponsor it upon introduction. And when you consider that that those Democrats represent such people as Charles Rangel of New York, Jim Oberstar of Minnesota, individuals who are across the ideological breadth of our party, I think the Department of Peace is an idea whose time has come. People are looking for peaceful alternatives.
Well, Congressman Kucinich, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I look forward to returning. Thank you.
Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich running for the nomination of the Democratic Party for president. Thanks. You're listening to Democracy Now! Rick MacArthur will join us next, publisher of Harper's, here to dissect a front-page piece in the New York Times yesterday by Judith Miller. Its headline, "An Iraqi Scientist is Said to Assert Illicit Arms Kept Till Eve of War." Stay with us.
Skies blue. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. Mercy. All things and what they used to be. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, breaking the sound barrier. This just in. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix has charged that U.S. officials tried to discredit the work of inspectors in Iraq to justify invading the country. In an interview with the BBC, Blix said U.S. officials leaked suggestions that inspectors had deliberately suppressed information to the media in an attempt to undermine their work in Iraq. Excerpts of the interview were released just before Blix is due to address the UN Security Council today. Meanwhile, it appears the Pentagon propaganda apparatus is still in high gear as the U.S. struggles to explain why it has failed to find weapons of mass destruction so far, the main justification for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Yesterday, the New York Times ran a front-page piece by Judith Miller about a former Iraqi scientist who allegedly told a U.S. military team that Iraq destroyed chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment only days before the invasion began. The scientist also said Iraq secretly sent unconventional weapons and technology to Syria starting in the mid-90s, and that more recently Iraq has been cooperating with al-Qaeda. The New York Times says the Pentagon says the unnamed Iraqi scientist says that he led Americans to material that proved to be the building blocks for a toxic agent that is banned by chemical weapons treaties. U.S. officials said it's the most important discovery to date in the hunt for illegal weapons. The Pentagon is refusing to identify the toxic agent or the scientist. The piece by Judith Miller is... Miller is embedded in the U.S. military. She reported she was not allowed to write about the scientist for 3 days and that her report was submitted to military officials for censorship. Well, it seems that the piece accomplishes everything the Pentagon could wish for. We are joined right now by Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, but also author of a book on Pentagon and propaganda in the First Gulf War called The Second Front. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Your assessment of this piece. I want to say we invited the New York Times on, worked very hard yesterday to get them on to defend this piece, but in the end, they refused.
It's like talking to the government now, and what the Times has done is it's evolved from being the paper of record to being the repository of record. This story is a kind of watershed, I think, in the history of the paper, because what it does is it lifts the curtain on how they do journalism at the Times. Now, it's hard for the general public to follow these things. There's just too much being thrown at you. But you need to know that Judith Miller has been obsessed with Saddam Hussein for a long time and with Arab terrorism, and she's been taking the feed from the government for a long time, from security officials, from spies, from anybody who could sell her a story. And the worst thing she'd done to date was to promote the aluminum tubes fraud of last September, which has been completely refuted. The story being that the Iraqis are trying to buy aluminum tubes to revive their high-grade aluminum tubes to revive their weapons program, their nuclear weapons program. She promoted, inflated this story with another reporter at the Times named Michael Gordon. It was a leak from the White House, which was then turned around the next day on all the Sunday talk shows by Vice President Cheney, who was then able to cite the story in the New York Times about the imminent nuclear threat posed by the aluminum tubes, a story that he had leaked or that his people had leaked. Now we come to a story at a time when the American people are wondering, or at least some of us are wondering, where the weapons of mass destruction, so-called, are hidden, that we were supposed to be going after, that was the pretext for going into Iraq, or the premise for going into Iraq. They couldn't find any. Day after day, people were asking, no stories, no explanation. The good old reliable Judy Miller, comes through with a story from Met Alpha, which purports to be a weapons inspection or weapons uncovering unit, but is really a propaganda unit. And she does the most astonishing thing I've ever seen in a story in the New York Times, which was, by the way, put on the front page of the Times. She agrees, first of all, to a censorship, a gag, where she says, okay, I won't report this until you've vetted my story. She then agrees, and her editors agree, to have certain details deleted from the story. And then she writes the following amazing paragraph. She says, while this reporter could not interview the scientist, she was permitted to see him from a distance at the sites where he said that material from the arms program was buried. Clad in nondescript clothes and a baseball cap, he pointed to several spots in the sand where he said chemical precursors and other weapons material were buried. This reporter also accompanied Met Alpha on the search for him and was permitted to permitted to examine a letter written in Arabic that he slipped to American soldiers, offering them information about the program and seeking their protection. Now, the notion of a New York Times reporter, first of all, agreeing to this kind of, or the New York Times agreeing to this gag is almost unprecedented, as far as I know. But to base a story on a single, and a very important story politically and historically, on a single source and the observation of a guy in a baseball cap at some distance pointing at the ground is beyond parody. But it's very dangerous parody. I mean, this is, when you said the other day, I was on the show the other day, you said, well, we're at the verge, or we're really at a point where we have a state media. And I sort of said, well, I'm not sure we're there, or I thought to myself, I'm not sure we're there. This is the closest thing I've ever seen to an American state media. You might as well just run the press release directly in the newspaper with no interpretation from the reporter or from the newspaper. Just print it, which, by the way, you seem to be seeing now. I'm not sure if this ad was run free or not, but this Homeland Security ad with Tom Ridge giving you tips on how to protect yourself against terrorist acts.
This looks like it's a full-page ad.
Yeah, it's co-sponsored by the Ad Council. I wonder if that's a freebie. I don't know. I'm going to call the Times today and find out if they gave this one away for free. But it begins to look more and more like a state media, like Pravda. We in the business have joked for years about the New York Times being the semi-official government newspaper. And they pride themselves in being, to some extent, the semi-official government paper, because that makes them the place where the government goes to give their information or the disinformation first. But this is beyond anything I've ever seen.
Well, Rick MacArthur, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
The piece again in front page yesterday's New York Times. Rick MacArthur is the publisher of Harper's Magazine, and that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdul Kudus, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org as we go out with the late Nina Simone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning.